the one-year anniversary of BP's Gulf oil disaster.
What they should have known is blowouts happen and we need to be prepared for a blowout. Somewhere in this region, we should have a piece of equipment that is designed to stop a deep water blowout.
That's Carl Safina. We'll spend the hour with him talking about the Deepwater Horizon blowout, why it happened, and what it did. His new book, just out this week, is A Sea in Flames. That's our show today on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riano. When the news broke the first week of April that Transocean executives received a bonus for exemplary safety this year, you could have thought it was an April Fool's joke. But then we heard that deepwater oil drilling has begun again in the Gulf, and BP has just submitted a request for a permit to resume drilling there. Meanwhile, the fishing and tourist industries have still not recovered. Dolphins are dying in droves, and game fish are coming up with diseased fins. The true toll of the Deepwater Horizon disaster won't be known for many years. And many questions remain, even about who is at fault or for how much, questions that will be hashed out in the courts for years to come. But just in time for the anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, marine ecologist and writer Carl Safina has come out with a book that tells its story in writing that crackles with energy and passion. The book is A Sea in Flames. He calls it an emotional topography of the blowout. But it's driven by more than emotion. Safina meticulously deconstructs what caused the blowout and the technical, biological, and emotional responses to it during the time the oil was flowing. Then he pauses for reflection to ask who and what is to blame, not just for the blowout, but the many failures of the response. And finally, Safina talks about the effects of the blowout on fish in the Gulf and comes up with some surprising opinions. I started out by asking Carl Safina to read from the beginning pages of A Sea in Flames when the blowout is about to happen.
A churning drill bit sent from a world of light and warmth and living beings. More than 3 miles under the sea surface, more than 2 miles under the seafloor. Eternal darkness, unimaginable pressure. The drill bit has met a gas pocket, that tiny pinprick, that pressure. Mere bubbles, a mild fizz from deep within. The sudden influx of gas into the well, rushing up the pipe, gas expanding like crazy. Through the open gates onto the seafloor, 1 more mile to the sea surface. The beings above are experiencing some difficulty managing it. A variety of people face a series of varied decisions. They don't make all the right ones. Explosion, fireball, destroyed 11 men, created 9 widows, 21 fatherless kids, including one who'll soon be born, 17 injured, 115 survive with pieces of the puzzle lodged in their heads. Only the rig rests in peace, 1 mile down. Only the beginning. Blowout, gusher, wild well. Across the whole region, the natural systems shudder. Months to control it. Years to get over it. Human lives changed by the hundreds of thousands. Effects that ripple across the country, the hemisphere, the world. Imperfect judgment at sea and in offices in Houston, perhaps forgivable. Inadequate safeguards, perhaps unforgivable. No amount of money enough, beyond payable.
So you tell this complex story, and you tell it basically in three parts, that there are three parts to this story, to what happened, and to this book. What caused the well to blow out, right. The varied impacts of it, technological, biological, the emotional responses during the months that the oil was flowing, and I think we can all remember that time. And then a little more insight after the flow of oil was stopped. So let's start with what caused it.
The first thing is that a lot of really bad decisions caused it. It wasn't just a sheer accident in the sense of a well-maintained piece of equipment suddenly breaks. That's what I would call a sheer accident. Here it was a variety of risks that were taken and a variety of risks that were recognized and then waved away. So the first problem was that the mixture of cement that was going to plug the well, because this was an exploratory well, they were just going to find oil and gas. They found it, and then what they were supposed to do was put a cork in it, a cement cork, and leave it for a different kind of rig to come and actually commercialize the oil and gas. The cement cork is down miles below the seafloor. It's not just that they're in mile deep water and they punch a hole in the seafloor and there's the oil and gas. They drill 2.5 more miles into the seafloor before they get to that layer with the oil and gas in it. It's about 240 degrees Fahrenheit down that deep, and there's incredible pressure. So the cement you use is not just a few sacks of concrete from the hardware store. It's a very sophisticated mixture, and it's supposed to make a plug in the well that is hundreds of feet high through hundreds of feet of the well bore. It's supposed to be filled with concrete. They used a mixture that failed several initial tests and then seemed to work, so they used it. That's very risky. Normally, if it worked several times and then failed, you should say, well, maybe not, right? Because you need something that you know will work. They had something that appeared not to work very well, and they used that anyway. Then, on the day when they are supposed to take the equipment out, this is when the problem really happened, because what you have in the well is this fluid that they call drilling fluid or drilling mud. It's not really mud. It's an artificial fluid. And it is heavier than water. And it is plugging the well all the way from the rig down into the well. So there's a miles high column of this liquid. The well is about 3 feet across at the top and about 7 inches across all the way at the bottom. So it's this narrow bore like a straw. And they have miles of liquid that's heavier than water. So imagine picking up a bucket of water. It's heavy. Now imagine if the bucket was 2.5 miles long. That's pretty heavy. That weight holds down the pressure of any oil and gas trying to get up during normal drilling or if the cement has failed. So the way you see if the cement is working is you start removing that fluid and replacing it with seawater, which is lighter, and it's like taking your foot slowly off the brake. What you want to have happen is nothing moves. If you take your foot slowly off the brake and you start to move, you put your foot down on the brake again. So in this case, they are starting to relieve the pressure, and they're looking at a couple of pressure gauges up on the rig. Now, another thing that they had done is they had a problem with that very heavy fluid getting lost into the surrounding loose gravel and rock. So they needed to seal the well. This was a couple of months beforehand. And they put this very heavy, viscous stuff down the well. That's a little bit like the stuff that you can spray into a leaking tire to fix a flat from the inside so that they wouldn't lose any more fluid. Because all that fluid, that several miles of fluid costs about $750,000. They don't want it going into the rock. And if they lose the pressure on it, they can't really control what's there. So they use this very heavy fluid. It worked on the first try, but they had mixed two batches. So they were stuck with a batch of very thick fluid on the rig. And they could dispose of it in two ways, according to the rules. They would either have to cart it back to shore and dispose of it as hazardous waste, which would all cost money, or they could mix it with regular drilling fluid and send it down the well. And then when it came up to the surface, they could direct it overboard and just dump it into the ocean. So they chose to do that. And it's very thick stuff designed to plug leaks. That was mixed with the fluid that they had on the last day. So as they were relieving the pressure and replacing the fluid with seawater, they were looking at two gauges. Their protocol says you look at this one gauge, we'll call it gauge A on a particular line, and it should read no pressure, zero, as you are relieving the downward weight. If it's showing pressure building, it means oil and gas is coming up and the cement has failed. So that pressure gauge continued to show zero. But there was another pressure gauge, we'll call it gauge B, that was showing pressure building. And basically, they looked in their instruction booklet and they said, well, it says to look at gauge A, and gauge A says no pressure. And they asked themselves, well, how do we explain pressure in gauge B? One of the people came up with an explanation for it that turns out to be completely wrong, a little bit like having your oil pressure light come on in the car, and your explanation to yourself is there's probably something wrong with the oil pressure light, instead of thinking there's something wrong with my oil and I should just stop. So instead of just stopping, they continued. The gauge showing pressure building was actually telling them the right thing. Pressure was building. The cement had failed and oil and gas was forcing its way upward. The other gauge that was showing no pressure turns out to have been clogged with that heavy viscous stuff that they really were using in a very irregular way that many people say they should never have done to begin with. Plus, they were directing it overboard instead of back onto the rig where they would normally be bringing the drilling fluid to recapture it. By directing it overboard, they were bypassing several other pressure gauges that could have warned them to escalating pressure in the well that was forcing that fluid up at abnormally elevated pressures. They should have had no upward pressure on it.
If you've just joined Reuters Voice, I'm talking with Carl Safina about his new book, just out this week, A Sea in Flames. It's about the Deepwater Horizon oil blowout in the Gulf that happened 1 year ago on April 20th. Now, recently I read in the New York Times that they discovered there was also a problem in the blowout preventer, piece that got bent.
They discovered a lot more about what the nature of the problem was, but the blowout preventer is a 40-foot high stack of various valves and cutting shears that stays on the seafloor at the top of the well. And the pipe that is the, you know, basically the well pipe and the drilling pipe go through that. And if they have a big problem, they can either tighten down a gasket against the pipe or they can shear the pipe and seal the well. That's what's supposed to happen in the case of a blowout. So they had a blowout. They realized that everything was out of control. The gas that was rushing onto the rig got sucked into the generators where it was supposed to be sucking in just air. It was sucking in gas, which was flammable. They started over revving. There were sparks, and the sparks ignited the explosions that then set the whole thing on fire. So the rig became like a giant Bunsen burner, and they tried to shear the pipe, but nothing was responding. And what they found was that after the blowout, probably a couple of days later, there were other attempts because the ROVs, the remote controlled vehicles, were down there also trying to get the blowout preventer to cut the pipe, and it wouldn't. So the new revelation is that the upward pressure forced the pipe up, but a joint got stuck and prevented it from going all the way through the blowout preventer, and the upward pressure continued, so it bent the pipe about an inch and a half off of the center point where it would normally be, and the cutting shear could not cut it if it was an inch and a half off of center. So basically all the oil and gas that came out of there for 4 months came through a space that was about an inch and a half wide.
All those millions of gallons?
Yes, because the pressure was so incredible that it was forcing it out at such an intense rate that you could get tens of thousands of barrels coming through an inch and a half hole over the course of a 24-hour period. And it went on for 4 months.
How much did the corporate culture of BP, Halliburton, and Transocean contribute to the accident?
Yeah, well, that's why I said I don't think it's really an accident. I think it's almost the inevitable result of people who take risks all the time. There were other really risky things that did not result in the blowout, but they were really risky things. They were constantly doing stuff, making decisions that said, well, this isn't really that important. This doesn't really matter that much. Oh, we could do it this way anyway. And not all of those added up to the blowout, but some of them did add up to the blowout. So this to me is, it's a disaster chain, but the disaster is in a lot of extremely faulty decision-making and a culture that was telling them, hurry up, this is costing money. Yes, we want to be safe, but hurry up. And people saying, well, it'll be okay this way. Or there was one email that where somebody was questioning the cement, and the response back was not just the cement and the way that the well bore was going to have these things called spacers in it to make sure that the cement would be able to trickle down in an even way. And they decided to go with a riskier configuration, and somebody questioned that in an email, a BP employee, and his superior said, well, who cares? It's done, and we'll probably get a good cement job. Well, I mean, everything was riding on them getting a good cement job, and they took a lot of risks along the way to that, saying, well, we'll probably get a good cement job, instead of saying, at all costs, we must ensure a good cement job, or instead of spending a few million extra to take a few days, we might be on the hook for $40 billion, $80 billion. And the worst public relations fiasco that any corporation could have, which is what happened to them as a result of acting irresponsibly and trying to be in a rush and not being careful.
Now, this also extended then to their emergency response plan. You know, it seemed to all of us who were watching the TV that they were hapless. They didn't know what to do.
They essentially had no emergency response plan. The idea was that if everything goes wrong, we have a blowout preventer and we'll just cut the pipe. But blowouts do happen. And what they should have known is blowouts happen and we need to be prepared for a blowout. Somewhere in this region where we have 30,000 wells that we've drilled and there are hundreds of companies and facilities and warehouses and hardware and ships and helicopters and everything, somewhere we should have a piece of equipment that is designed to stop a deep water blowout. But they had no equipment. They just relied on the idea that if everything goes wrong, well, we have the blowout preventer. Well, obviously, blowout preventers don't always prevent blowouts. They had nothing. Plus, they had these written response plans that were just cut and pasted from Alaska. Nobody was paying much attention. They said how they were going to save the walruses and the sea lions and other things that don't live in the Gulf of Mexico. So people were not paying attention to response. The law is based on an Exxon Valdez-type tanker accident where a finite amount of oil is spilled at the surface. And once it's spilled, it stops getting spilled because it's finished, and you need to clean it up. The law didn't have anything in it for stopping a leak. They just had basically mopping up a surface spill. So all of these things that were foreseeable because they happen, there have been a lot of other blowouts in this country and around the world. They're less severe. They were brought under control more quickly, but they obviously do happen. So their response was like saying, oh my God, the house is burning. Maybe we need to like build a truck that could carry water and have guys that can handle hoses. And so they started at square one after the house was on fire. And their whole strategy was, well, the house probably will never catch fire because we have smoke alarms.
You mentioned laws before. I mean, don't we have laws to make these kinds of precautions be taken, not just the precautions to stop a blowout, but also even the cleanup was completely inadequate?
Well, we don't have any laws that say what to do to stop a blowout. It was just completely overlooked by everybody. And the idea that if there's a lot of oil, we'll just put dispersants on it and we'll have these booms. This is what they've had for the last 30 or 40 years, and nothing has progressed, even though 30 or 40 years ago, they weren't anywhere near water as deep as they're in now. So the drilling technology has accelerated beyond belief, and the cleanup technology hasn't moved.
And we're talking with Carl Safina. His latest book, just out, is Sea in Flames. It's about the Deepwater Horizon disaster and the impacts of it, how it happened. You talk about booms when you talk about going to the Gulf and seeing the oil just washing right over these booms. What was happening out there with this cleanup? Did anything work? Did anything help?
Well, after the oil was flowing, and it flowed for 4 months, and no one knew if it was going to flow for 4 months or a year or 5 years. No one really understood what was going on or what the parameters of the whole situation were going to be. So people became hysterical. And there was a lot of reason to be extremely concerned. And then people also did a lot of things that were just nutty and thought a lot of things that were just nutty and extreme. Many of the fishermen thought that they would never go back to fishing in their lifetimes. Their children would never see a fish or a shrimp out of the Gulf of Mexico, that the whole place was permanently destroyed. A lot of people whose income has to do with real estate and beachfront aesthetics also believed that they were permanently ruined. And BP had everybody going out and putting these booms all over the place because they really didn't have anything else for anyone to do that would actually work. So the booms didn't work, and they couldn't have worked. They're not designed to stop massive amounts of oil in open water. What they're designed to do is if you have a boat that's tied to a dock and while it's refueling, it spills 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel. You can put booms around a ship like that and contain the diesel fuel. But to contain millions of gallons in water that is subject to waves and wind and tides with these floating booms that are only a foot or foot and a half in diameter is just complete nonsense. They had shrimp boats towing the booms in U-shape configurations from the outriggers that they normally tow their nets. And you could easily see from the air that all of the water and all of the oil was going over the boom. They were just stirring it. They weren't collecting it or picking it up or doing anything of the sort. The booms themselves, which were along the shore, had lots and lots of spaces in them. They weren't complete, you know, it wasn't a complete wall of, or not even a wall because they float, but it wasn't a complete line of booms. And within a day or two of any kind of wind and waves, they were up on the beach. They just got pushed ashore, and then there was nothing at all except oil and booms on the beach in a big mess.
So you went down there. What did you say? You went to, is it called Grand Isle? Well, you went all around the area. But tell us a little bit about of what you witnessed. You're a biologist, an ecologist, a marine ecologist. What did you witness there in terms of the effects?
I went to southern Louisiana from about Grand Isle, which if you think of the very, very tip of Louisiana, Grand Isle is a little west of there. I went a little east of there, and then I also went east in the northern Gulf to Alabama and to the panhandle of Florida. The oil was, of course, the heaviest nearest the blowout. It was washing up very heavily at times around Grand Isle. They got it the worst. East of there, it was washing up very irregularly. A lot of it sort of was pinwheeling around in the Gulf. The winds and the waves did not make things worse. They actually helped. We were kind of lucky that way. And
how was that?
Well, if there was a lot of very strong south winds or a hurricane or something like that, that would have pushed it all along the Gulf shore, it would have been much worse on the shore than it was. And that didn't really happen. There was a little bit of that, but not any really big hurricanes. And the current that would normally sort of pick it up and take it around along South Florida and then push it past the Florida Keys was not flowing that way. It pinched itself off in an eddy that was spiraling around for quite a while. So there was some luck involved in that. And then because the Gulf is very, very hot at the surface, and it happened in the summer, a lot of the oil that was at the surface was melting at the surface and then evaporating. And when by the time it got to shore, a lot of it was more like tar, or it was thicker. It wasn't this gooey stuff, or like it wasn't like just having motor oil all over the beach. It was in kind of thick splatters that were a little more contained, and it was very awful for a while. It was a nightmare for a while in southern Louisiana, but once the oil stopped flowing, then the oil in the water started dissipating. It was being dispersed, and it was subject to the sun. It was subject to all the microbes that are in the Gulf that can basically eat petroleum, and it began to disperse for the next few months.
Now, one issue that many people were concerned about is that the oil was coming from very deep. So one thing is the surface oil, and we know that BP used the Corexit dispersant so that we wouldn't see the oil on the surface. But what about all the oil that was underneath the surface?
Right. Well, the truest answer to all these questions about what about all this stuff and what's going to happen in the long term is no one knows. But the indications are that it was not as bad as many people feared. For one thing, if you look at the entire Gulf of Mexico, just the surface, forget the volume, there was oil at the surface in only about 5% of the whole Gulf of Mexico, a much larger fraction of U.S. waters in the Gulf of Mexico. But it was kind of contained because the currents and the wind were not really pushing it and distributing it. All of that stuff, all of the dispersants, which they used at the bottom and at the surface, they had, I would say, a legitimate interest in trying to prevent oil from coming ashore once they stuck themselves with this enormous problem, and an illegitimate interest in trying to hide the oil because their liability is based on how much oil. They were telling us 1,000 barrels a day, and then the academic scientists determined, no, more like 60,000 barrels a day, not 160. And BP is now saying, no, it's more like a lot less than 60. So they're just trying to do what people like them always do, which is they only are trying to reduce their financial liability. They don't care what the real number is. They only care what they can convince people it might have been, by casting lots of doubt on everything. But if there's any doubt, there's a lot more doubt on BP saying how much oil came out than there is on independent academic scientists saying how much oil they think was coming out. Mm-hmm. So the a lot of that oil is toxic. It probably killed a lot of plankton and a lot of fish eggs and things like that. I did see even small fish swimming under very obvious oil at the surface. So it didn't kill everything instantly, and I don't know, and no one knows how many of those fish survived the whole thing, how many of those fish survived for weeks and then died, or anything like that.
Carl Safina. We're talking about his new book, A Sea in Flames. It's about the Deepwater Horizon disaster and is being published this week, marking the first anniversary of the day the rig exploded. This is Writer's Voice. We'll talk more after a break.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take these arms, arms, I'll never use them. Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry? How can I get along without you? You got the part that once was my heart, so why not take all of me?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with marine ecologist and author Carl Safina about his newest book, A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Blowout. Just before the break, Safina was telling us that the long-term effects may not be as bad as everyone, including him, feared. And does this mean that the oil basically is gone, that it's not going to continue to contaminate these areas? I mean, can there be, aren't there long-term effects that we're still seeing in Alaska where the Exxon Valdez happened?
There are long-term effects we're still seeing in Alaska. That was apparently the most damaging event having to do with spilled oil ever. And there are still ducks, for instance, whose reproduction is really depressed, and they still have liver problems because there's a lot of oil still in the gravel and the beaches. It keeps coming out. But it was much heavier oil in a much more confined place, in a much colder place where it doesn't dissipate as much over time. I mean, the dissipation there is much, much slower. So with far less oil, that was a much more destructive spill, it seems. And it does seem that in the Gulf, there is a lot of dissipation, natural and otherwise, and the longer that it's drifting around, the more diluted it's getting, and the dose is what makes the poison. It's not that anything that comes near one molecule of petroleum will die, it's that the toxicity of the petroleum depends on how concentrated it is. So it's very unlikely that it's getting more dangerous or more toxic or is killing more things at a greater rate now than it was killing when it was fresh, still gushing out, and much more concentrated. So I don't expect that the long-term events are likely to be worse than the short-term events and consequences were. But there may be some surprises. Like recently, baby dolphins were washing ashore dead at a rate that was 10 times normal. The question is that because of the oil? Is it because people are looking better, or is there something else killing the dolphins? Do they have some epidemic that is killing them? If they do have an epidemic, is that related back to the oil and its effect on their immune system while they were pregnant? I mean, there are things that, and people don't know the answers to those questions. But my guess is that in the medium term, there will be a pretty quick recovery of basically everything in the Gulf as far as people can see and detect it. The only thing that we know will take years is that lots and lots of oysters got killed in Louisiana, and they got killed not by the oil. They got killed by the fresh water that was released in massive quantities to try to create a current out of the delta to push any oil away from the shoreline. So inadvertently, people killed lots and lots of oysters, and they will take years to recover, you know, maybe 5 to 7 years to recover.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because it seems in some ways the response could be worse than the original. The response to the exposure to the spill could be worse. You mentioned this flushing of water. This happened at the behest of, was that right, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana? Yeah.
Yes, he and a few other people, that was their idea. Well, sometimes, you know, people in crisis mode, and when everybody's running around worrying and wondering and wringing their hands about what can we do when there is no preparedness, they make faulty decisions in response as well. And they did that also. One thing that I and lots of people worried about was, is this going to kill loads of fish and loads of shrimp? But when they started reopening the areas, because they closed an awful lot of the Northern Gulf to fishing, when they started reopening the areas, they found that the fishing was absolutely excellent because there were millions and millions and millions of fish there that had not been caught all summer that would have been caught in a normal summer. So I think, ironically, if you ask a fish, would it like another blowout in 2011 or a season of normal fishing, you might get the fish to vote for a referendum that says, give us another blowout. I don't know. But it's certainly ironic that from a fish's point of view, fishing might be the worst catastrophe.
Fishing might be the worst catastrophe in the Gulf, but that there are other insults and assaults, ones that are really have been ongoing for a long time. Talk just a little bit about those.
Mostly everything that people were worried about, which is the marshes and this and the effects of the spilled oil on the ocean creatures. Those things are suffering terribly, but not because of the blowout and not because of spilled oil. They're suffering from things that have been happening for decades that are ongoing, and they're suffering because of the oil that we don't spill. So what's been happening for decades? Well, two things. One is that the marshes of the Great Mississippi Delta, which is just an absolutely staggeringly vast system of wetlands, those marshes are falling apart. They're disintegrating at a rate of about 25,000 acres a year. It's an unimaginable amount until you actually get to see how big that place is and talk to people who can tell you how much of what was marshland is now open water over the last 30 years of their lifetimes, what they've seen. And you can see the progression of what was cypress forests that is now adjacent to lots of dead standing cypress trees that are adjacent to marshland that used to be cypress, that is adjacent to open water that used to be marsh. And you can see that pretty easily. Why are the marshes disintegrating? Everybody thought the oil would kill the marshes, but the oil barely touched the edges of the marshes. And where it did in most places, a lot of the marsh began growing back by the end of the summer. The area right around Grand Island, Barataria Bay, was very badly oiled, and that oil there is still a big problem there. What's really destroying the marshes is that they need the silt and mud from the Mississippi River to which created them. That's why they're there, because the mud built those marshes. They need the marshes. The marshes need to have mud and silt constantly distributed across them by the Mississippi River, which had a mouth that would normally wave like a fire hose back and forth over long periods of time, that built and maintained those marshes. So what did they do? They channelized the mouth of the river. They deepened it. It now just shoots all that mud straight out into the Gulf, and the marshes are being starved from above. They're also being eaten from below because we've cut 10,000 miles of channels and canals through the marshland, and when you dice them up like that, they start crumbling. The more they crumble, the wider the water gets, the more it crumbles. And it's like a red carpet for hurricanes that just come roaring up there, and gigantic amounts of marshland just dissolve during those hurricanes, never to be re-nourished by mud and silt from the Mississippi as they would have been, because that's getting shot straight out to the Gulf. We also send all the pollution from the middle of the country down the Mississippi River, all of the nitrogen fertilizer, lots of toxic chemicals, estrogen from birth control pills, caffeine, you name it, all kinds of stuff that we use and that comes through our bodies that has created a dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River, which has gotten wider and bigger every summer for the last 30 years or so, and is now the size of some small state like Delaware, is often compared to, or New Jersey, I think was the most recent thing, because it's getting bigger. So these problems that have been going on for decades are what's really killing the marshes of the Mississippi Delta. The blowout isn't, and the blowout really has very little, if anything, to do with those problems. So people tend to look only at these short-term catastrophes, and then they think, well, okay, that seems all right, and we'll just move on to the next thing. But the longer-term problems are still there, and they're still destroying those things. The other thing is the oil that we use is much worse than the oil that we spill.
So what the picture I'm getting here that we're getting is that it's the oil that we burn that's more dangerous than the oil that was released during this blowout. But you're not really saying that deep water drilling by itself is a harmless thing. There are places where it could be a much, much more difficult prospect. And of course, all the deep water drilling is drilling for the purpose of us burning it eventually.
Well, that's the big point, is that it contributes a lot to the overall problem, even if nothing goes, quote, wrong. But when something does go wrong, it goes wrong in a very big way. A lot of people were saying that the blowout could not have happened in a worse place at a worse time. I said that too, because it was right at the beginning of the migration season for all the birds. But in retrospect, it was probably the best place at the best time that it could have happened. It happened in late spring when the place was heating up and a lot of it would just normally start to evaporate from the surface, a relatively stable time of the year. There's a lot more wind and a lot more churning around in the winter that could have brought more of it ashore. And later in the summer, there are more hurricanes that could have brought more of it ashore. So a relatively hot, relatively stable time. And where? In a place where there's an unbelievable amount of equipment and boats and ships and people and everything that can go out pretty much anytime they want to. You have something like that happen in Alaska in the winter, or any cold place in the winter where there's sea ice, where you can't operate equipment, where you have to just shut everything for the entire winter and it's dark all the time and the oil is thick and will not dissipate or evaporate on its own. That would be an inconceivable mess.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Carl Safina about A Sea in Flames. It's about the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf. So what's happening with that? I mean, we heard after the BP oil disaster that the Arctic drilling was going to be off the table, but it seems I've heard recently that it's back on.
Some of the drilling in some parts of Alaska were off the table, and some are still very much on the table, or in one area. It's off the table this year while they write new response plans. But it's certainly not off the table. What is off the table is good energy legislation, which had some hope of passing last spring, ironically, until the blowout. The blowout should have been what really pushed the momentum for finally phasing away from fossil fuels and phasing toward clean energy, and as if we needed that to remind us of all the good reasons. But it didn't. Ironically, part of the trade-off for getting Republican support for the climate legislation was giving certain, mainly Republican states with Republican governors, more oil drilling in the near term off their coast. So they said, okay, we want more oil drilling and we'll support longer term climate legislation if we get more oil drilling. Obviously, not really the way to plan long term, but that's the way politics went. Then when the blowout happened, everybody said, well, you know what? Maybe we don't want oil drilling off our coast. Our people are saying now we don't want oil drilling off our coast. So without that part of it, the climate legislation just died. It just died.
And there was more politics, too. On the one hand, you know, there was a moratorium of oil drilling in the Gulf. And on the other hand, and people, the fishermen, were just really getting hammered. And on the other hand, we have the prospect of Governor of Louisiana, Mary Landrieu, and other residents as well, saying we've got to, you know, if you're going to have an oil moratorium, we're going to lose jobs. So talk a little bit about this and how has that all played out now?
I really don't think they should have instituted an oil drilling moratorium right after the blowout, because I think they could have beefed up safety a lot quickly. and not distracted everybody and handed them basically a hammer to beat them over the oil moratorium, because that made everybody hate the Obama administration more because they had this moratorium. And, you know, it was very unlikely that in the middle of that blowout, the companies themselves weren't a little more careful, and these kinds of blowouts don't happen very often. So it was very unlikely that we were going to suddenly have another blowout within a few months. I think they just should have beefed up the rules, beefed up the safety inspections, put more inspectors on the rigs, broken up the Minerals Management Service to do what they did do to remove the incentives for lax oversight by breaking it into an enforcement arm and a permitting arm. And they could have just done all of that anyway without a temporary moratorium that created this enormous political firestorm that really didn't do anything one way or another, in my opinion. I don't think that politically it was a smart thing to do, and I don't think environmentally it was a necessary thing to do.
For much of his book, A Sea in Flames, Carl Safina lambasts Tad Allen for kowtowing to BP. He's the admiral who led the Coast Guard response to the oil disaster. But then Safina got a chance to meet Allen and learned that the situation was a bit more complicated.
Well, I had a very dim view of Tad Allen for the whole summer, because the main thing that enraged me about the way the summer was going was that BP was in charge of everything. It became a little mini police state down there with lots of private guards, not even regular police, kicking people off of public beaches, telling them they couldn't go down public roads, telling people they couldn't take pictures of BP headquarters, all kinds of just awful, dopey things that were completely useless and totally un-American and asinine all around. And the Coast Guard was, to a large extent, allowing that to happen. What I didn't realize until actually talking to Tad Allen was that the law tied the Coast Guard's hands in that respect, A. And B, Tad Allen had signed a directive saying that the public has to have access anywhere at any time. And that's just simply was basically ignored by lots of people, with the complicity of local sheriffs and things like that.
So you're saying that the law said that BP actually had to be the one in charge of the response, and that when the government tried to cut through the red tape and bring some sense to this, that it just got flouted.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So the law was enacted a year after the Exxon Valdez spill, and the entire model was a tanker spills oil, and how is it going to get cleaned up? And the law says, well, you can't expect the public to clean it up. You spilled it, you clean it up. That's sensible. Nobody thought that it's also possible that lots of oil will come out of a well and leak for months, and that the implications of putting the leaker or the spiller in charge are that you sort of hand them the keys to the kingdom. You don't just make them clean up the oil, which would be fine, and that's what the intention was, but you sort of let them move lots of equipment to a certain place and then hire guards to close the place, even if it's a public beach, or harass people with cameras, or deny reporters access to take a look at what's going on, or to take photographs of oiled animals and things like that. Now, you know, that part of it was extremely troubling and really annoying and very frustrating. That was also leaky, because plenty of images did come out and plenty of people did find a way in. But never, ever in this country should the public and the media be denied access because it makes a company who has done something horrendous look bad. And that's what happened. It had nothing to do with anybody's safety. I mean, that's what they always say. Mm-hmm. Safety or or they could be terrorists. I mean, they were even saying, well, people were taking photographs of BP headquarters. Maybe they're terrorists. Well, how likely is that when BP is in the news every day because their oil well is gushing? How likely is it that people are taking pictures of their headquarters because they are terrorists? Maybe they're taking pictures of their headquarters because there's a lot of oil gushing out of their well.
Safina also says that BP's record is mixed, not all bad.
I do think that the company was absolutely reckless. I think that a lot of their behavior all summer was inane. They made a lot of statements that were really dopey. On the other hand, they did some good things. They paid a lot of people for their losses during the summer while all the fishing was closed and while the tourists were all staying away. I'm sure that they felt under tremendous pressure to do that because people would have rioted and gone crazy. Mm-hmm. And they risked losing their access to U.S. waters. Exxon treated the people in Alaska much, much worse than BP treated the people in the Gulf.
You're saying that people are hitting the snooze button. What does need to be done to prevent a blowout like this from happening again?
First of all, blowouts happen, so you better be ready to stop it from gushing when it happens. It is, after all, an oil well. The companies are designed to make holes in the seafloor and get all the oil that comes up out of that hole. So you would think that they would figure out and be able to figure out how to build a piece of equipment or a few different contingencies to deal with a blowout because they are inevitable. There needs to be much greater oversight. The culture on the rigs has to be completely overhauled so that if one gauge says no pressure and the other gauge says there's pressure building, you just stop. You don't look at some manual and says the manual says look at gauge A. You just stop. Obviously, there's something screwy going on. Just stop. The oversight, I think there should be, you know, supervisors from government agencies on the rigs. There needs to be a lot more oversight to make sure that things are always as safe as they could possibly be. But we also need to get off of oil. We're going deeper and deeper with more and more risk because we're running out of it in the easy places. We need to phase in a new era of clean, renewable energy that is the future. It powers the whole planet. We need to learn how to harness it. We can't keep using Stone Age approaches to just lighting stuff on fire every time we want energy or the 20th century's fuel source because it's ruining and risking major aspects of life and civilization on the planet to keep going this way.
Now, that's a big picture. That's a long term. But also you talk in the book about a plan for national monuments of the sea to protect fisheries. And I thought this was a very interesting suggestion. It's actually a suggestion of somebody else that you talk about there. Also because today I read about a new report that said that overfishing is being phased out, that there's a very, at least in the United States, there has been a successful implementation. So talk about this national monuments of the ocean. What would they do for us? And what do you think? Do you think that overfishing is on a positive trajectory downward?
Let's talk about overfishing first because it happened first and it's why we need these national monuments in the sea kind of idea. The main effect that people have had on the sea to date is through fishing, because fishing is designed to take what lives in the ocean and remove it, and it's gotten extremely good at that. Most populations of fish are extremely depleted almost everywhere in the world because of overfishing. It's just too much fishing, too unregulated for too many years. I've worked a lot on this issue, and I have written some of the language that is now actually in U.S. law about stopping overfishing, and I have worked on this for now 20 years, maybe 19 years. At first, we achieved the passage of the Sustainable Fisheries Act of 1996, and that said that overfishing had to be stopped within 10 years. Most fish had to be recovered to certain target levels that are overall more abundant than they are now. Not what they were a couple of hundred years ago, but a lot more abundant than they are now. But there were loopholes in that, because in the meantime, between the time that they had to have a plan and the time that they had to have the fish fully recovered, a lot of the managers were allowing continued overfishing, thinking that they could overturn the law in a few years and then they wouldn't have to worry about it. So over the course of several reauthorizations, I and other people who work on fishing policy have tightened those loopholes, because we've gotten Congress to see the logic in tightening the loopholes against a lot of opposition, but we managed to prevail so far, so that you can't have continued overfishing during the 10 years when you're supposed to be letting the fish rebuild. That is now illegal, and this is the year when all of the fish for which there are management plans, which is most of the commercially fished species in U.S. waters, may not be caught faster than they can reproduce starting this year. So we'll see how that goes and how well the compliance goes, but that's the situation with that. The U.S. is arguably the best country in the world, I would say the best big country in the world for doing fishery management well. Certainly not Europe. Africa is a total mess. Asia is a total wreck. And the U.S., because we do have this law with these mandates for recovery and these loopholes being closed in the last decade, doing better. A lot of the declines have been arrested, and some of the fish populations are on recovering trends. So then the idea of the monuments, Sylvia Earle, the famed oceanographer, has been pushing this a lot in the last few years. And Jane Lubchenco, the head of NOAA, likes this idea as well, and she liked it before she was the head of NOAA, of saying that there are places in the sea that we put off limits to other uses, or we designate for certain uses, like we designate these leased areas for oil drilling. Why don't we designate some areas for fish breeding and just leave them alone there, so that these sanctuaries can build up populations, can rebuild the structure, the age structure of fish, because a fish that is older lays many, many times more eggs than a fish that is younger. When a fish doubles in size, its egg-laying potential goes up by a factor of about 10, not by a factor of 2. So letting fish get big, letting them breed, is the way to maintain the viability of the ecology, but it's also a way to maintain a production area for fish that we would want to use. An analogy that I use is that you can't have every place be a retail store. You have to have some factories. If you don't have places where you're making stuff, you will have nothing in the retail stores. But we treat the whole ocean like it's a retail store, and we do need to have some designated factories.
Well, Carl Safina, your latest book, just out, is A Sea in Flames. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Safina is also about to launch a PBS TV series called Saving the Ocean, which is all about people who are already finding solutions to the ocean's problems and making them work. It'll start airing on select PBS stations in April. You can find a link to the show's website at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.